You know, it is wild to think about how much absolute trust we put into like a fragile piece of glass.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we just tap it and expect magic to happen.
Right. Whether you were shopping for a new pair of shoes or managing your life savings or just doom scrolling the morning news, you are relying on this massive, invisible infrastructure.
Yeah, and we expect it to be completely instantaneous.
Exactly. Flawless. But behind that glass screen is a vast, mind-bogglingly complex structural framework making the digital world run seamlessly.
It really is a modern marvel. You know, what we experience as a simple tap is actually this highly orchestrated global event. The architecture of a web application determines everything from, well, how fast a page loads to whether your credit card data is fundamentally secure.
Yeah, it's the whole package.
Right. It acts as the skeleton, the nervous system, and the brain of the digital ecosystem, all rolled into one.
And that is exactly our mission for this deep dive. We are taking you on a guided tour behind the screen of your favorite web apps.
It's going to be fun.
Yeah, we're going to demystify the choices engineers make that dictate how data flows across the globe in milliseconds, translating abstract code into the seamless experiences you use every single day. Okay, let's unpack this. Before we can understand how massive applications scale to millions of users, we have to look at the basic building blocks, the anatomy of the digital ecosystem.
Right.
And it really boils down to three main layers.
Yeah, right out of the gate, you have the client side, commonly called the front end. Then you have the server side, which is the back end.
The brains of the operation.
Exactly. And sitting beneath that is the persistence layer, which is where the data actually lives. Most people just think of this as the database.
Let's start with the front end, because that's the territory you and I actually interact with. It's the user interface. At its core, we have this foundational trio. HTML gives the page its structure, like the actual text and image placements. CSS handles all the styling, the colors, the layouts, and JavaScript provides the interactivity, making a button actually do something when you click it.
Right, but nobody is building complex apps with just raw JavaScript anymore.
I was going to ask about that. They aren't.
Not if they want to maintain their sanity. When you build a modern application, you have to manage a constantly changing
Like
interface.
a Twitter feed or something.
Exactly. Think of a social media feed where new posts are loading, like counts are updating in real time, and chat windows are popping up. To handle that, developers use UI frameworks like React, Angular, Vue.js, or Svelte.
Okay.
These frameworks act as powerful engines that efficiently update only the specific parts of the screen that need to change, rather than reloading the whole page every time.
That makes sense. But then you hear about all these behind-the-scenes front-end tools like bundlers, things like Vite and Webpack,
Yeah.
or state management tools like Redux, ZooStand, or Pinia. To a layperson, that just sounds like a tidal wave of jargon. What are these actually doing for the user?
Think of a bundler like packing a suitcase for a long trip. If a developer writes 1,000 different tiny JavaScript files to keep their code organized, the user's browser would have to make 1,000 individual requests to download them.
Oh, which would take forever.
Right. Bundlers like Webpack or Vite compress all those files into one neat, highly optimized package so the app loads instantly on your phone.
Oh, that's brilliant. And the state management tools.
State management is essentially the application's short-term memory.
How so?
Well, imagine you are shopping online. You click Add to Cart on a product page. The little cart icon in the top right corner of the screen needs to instantly update from a 1 to a 2. State management tools like Redux are the central nervous system making sure every distinct component on the screen knows exactly what is happening everywhere else, keeping the entire interface synchronized.
Okay, so that's the front end, highly organized, optimized, and tracking our every click. Behind that sits the back end, the powerhouse. This is usually running on a cloud hosting platform, like your AWS, Google Cloud, or Azure. And engineers have to choose a server language. They might pick Node.js because its asynchronous nature handles thousands of simultaneous connections incredibly fast. Or they might use Python because it's highly readable and great for data-heavy processing. Or maybe Ruby or PHP.
Yeah, and just like the front end, the back end has its own frameworks.
Oh, really?
Because nobody wants to reinvent the wheel. Frameworks like Express.js for Node or Django for Python provide the scaffolding. They give developers pre-built ways to handle user authentication, route web traffic, and enforce security rules.
So they don't have to code a login screen from scratch every single time.
Exactly. The back end does all the heavy lifting, processes the business logic, and ultimately acts as the gatekeeper to the third layer, the persistence layer.
The databases. And there's a massive philosophical split here between SQL and NoSQL. SQL databases like MySQL are relational. I always picture them like a giant, incredibly strict Excel spreadsheet.
That's a good way to look at it.
Yeah, every piece of data has to fit perfectly into predefined columns and rows, which makes them perfect for highly structured things, like accounting software.
Yeah.
Contrast that with NoSQL databases, like MongoDB, which are non-relational. Instead of strict rows, they store data as flexible documents.
Meaning what, exactly?
Meaning if one user profile has a phone number but the next one doesn't, NoSQL doesn't care. It's like throwing things into a highly organized, flexible folder system. It's fantastic for unstructured data and scales across massive server clusters much easier than SQL.
But neither of those is great for everything, right? Like, you wouldn't stuff a 4K video file directly into a database table.
Oh, definitely not. That would bring the database to its knees almost immediately.
Right.
For massive binary objects, images, videos, PDFs, you use specialized object storage like AWS S3. You drop the heavy video file into S3, and then you just store a tiny text link to that video inside your actual database.
Got it. I've been trying to visualize how these three layers interact, and tell me if this analogy works.
Okay, let's hear it.
We go to a restaurant. The front end is the dining room. It's what the customer sees. It's the ambiance, the menu, the waiter interacting with you. The back end is the kitchen.
Yeah.
It's taking your order, applying the business logic of a recipe, cooking the food. And the persistence layer, the database, is the pantry where all the raw ingredients are securely stored.
It's a great baseline analogy, but I'll push it a little further to explain a critical concept, which is decoupling.
Decoupling?
Yeah. In a modern architecture, that kitchen isn't physically attached to just one dining room because the layers are entirely separate. That single back-end kitchen can cook up data and serve it simultaneously to your website's web interface, to a native app on a user's mobile phone, and to an internal desktop application used by your staff.
Oh, wow.
The front-end dining rooms change, but the back-end kitchen and the recipe remain exactly the same.
That is incredibly efficient. So we know the components, but the highest impact design decision an engineering team makes is how to actually arrange them. Because putting everything into one giant warehouse behaves very differently than spreading it out across the specialized city.
True.
This brings us to architectural models.
The traditional starting point is the monolithic architecture. It's exactly what it sounds like. Everything, your front-end serving code, your back-end logic, your database access, lives in a single massive code base. It is deployed as one giant unit.
Which is perfect for an early stage startup, right?
Yeah.
If you have a team of two engineers trying to launch a minimum viable product, a monolith is incredibly simple to set up and test.
Yes, initially.
But the downside feels like a ticking time bomb.
Yeah.
Because everything is tangled together. A single bug in the product review section can crash the entire payment processing system.
Right.
And every time you want to change the color of a button, you have to shut down, rebuild, and redeploy the entire massive application.
Which becomes totally unmanageable when you have 100 engineers working on the same code at once. That's why, as companies scale, they migrate to a microservices architecture.
Okay, breaking it apart.
Exactly. You take that monolith and shatter it into smaller, fiercely independent services that talk to each other over the network via APIs. The checkout system is its own isolated service. The user profile system is its own isolated service. They even have their own separate databases.
So if the user profile service completely crashes because of a bad update, the checkout service is totally unaffected. People can still buy things. That fault isolation is huge.
It is, but nothing is free in software architecture. Microservices introduce a staggering amount of operational complexity.
I can imagine.
Instead of monitoring one application, your team is now monitoring 50 mini applications. And because these services are constantly sending messages to each other over the network, you introduce latency, those micro delays, as data travels from server to server. It's highly scalable for a massive enterprise, but absolute overkill for a simple tool.
Then you have serverless architecture, which sounds like magic, but it's really just handing the infrastructure keys over to a cloud provider using something like AWS Lambda.
Right. Serverless is a bit of a misnomer. There are still servers.
Just not yours. Instead of keeping a server running 24/7, you just write a tiny snippet of code, say, what happens when a user uploads a profile picture? The cloud provider spins up a machine for a fraction of a second, runs the code, and shuts it down. It auto-scales to zero, meaning if nobody is using your app at 3 a.m., you pay absolutely $0.
The trade-off there is the dreaded cold start latency.
Cold start.
Yeah. If a serverless function hasn't been triggered in a while, the cloud provider essentially puts it to sleep.
Wow.
When a new request comes in, it has to wake the system up, load the code, and execute it, which can cause a noticeable delay for the user. It's brilliant for bursty, unpredictable traffic or background processing, but terrible if you need guaranteed constant sub-millisecond response times.
Which leads us to the fourth model.
Yeah.
Event-driven architecture, or EDA. This is fascinating. Instead of components directly asking each other to do things, they produce and consume events via message brokers like Apache Kafka or RabbitMQ.
Yep.
So if I buy a pair of shoes, the checkout service doesn't directly tell the shipping service to send an item. It just drops a message into a central queue shouting, order placed.
Exactly.
And any service that cares about that event, shipping, inventory, receipt generation, picks up that message independently and does its job. If the shipping service goes offline for 10 minutes, it doesn't crash the checkout. The messages just wait patiently in the queue until the shipping service comes back online.
It is the ultimate form of decoupling. You gain incredible resilience because no service relies on another service being active at that exact millisecond.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though. If you use event-driven architecture, you introduce a concept called eventual consistency. Because these different services are pulling from the queue and reacting at slightly different times asynchronously, the system might not be perfectly synchronized for a fraction of a second. Wait, doesn't that mean a user might refresh their page and see outdated information? Is the massive engineering complexity of EDA actually worth that risk?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, you have to look at the business context. For a basic C-root application, meaning create, read, update, delete, like a simple to-do list, EDA is absurdly over-engineered.
Sure.
But imagine a high-stakes environment, a financial trading platform, a massive Internet of Things network, or a real-time hospital monitoring system. In those scenarios, you might have 30 different microservices that absolutely must react to a single business event. If a server blips out for 2 seconds during a massive wire transfer, you cannot afford to drop that data into the void.
Oh, absolutely not. That would be a disaster.
Exactly. The absolute guarantee that a message will be preserved in a queue and eventually processed makes ED mandatory, even if the user interface is only eventually consistent 100 milliseconds later. Resilience beats immediate consistency.
Wow. Okay, so that back-end architecture dictates how data flows in the dark. But how does that translate to the actual presentation layer, the screen the user is tapping on? We've got three main patterns to discuss: single-page applications, multi-page applications, and server-side rendered applications.
Let's focus on how these actually feel to the user. A single-page application, or SPA, is what you experience when you use Gmail.
Okay.
You load one single HTML page at the very beginning. As you click on different emails or open a draft, the browser doesn't load a new page. JavaScript just dynamically rewrites the content on the screen. It feels incredibly fluid, almost identical to a native mobile app.
But the drawback is that the initial load can be a bit heavy, right?
Right.
And search engines sometimes struggle to index them because there aren't traditional URLs for every piece of content.
That's the classic SPA problem.
Contrast that with a multi-page application, an MPA. This is the old school web. Okay. Every single time you click a link, your browser asks the server for a completely new, freshly built HTML document. You literally leave one page and load another.
Yeah.
It's not as fluid, but it is flawless for search engine optimization. Google's web crawlers can easily read every separate page.
And then server-side rendered applications, SSRs, attempt to marry the two. When you type in a URL, the backend server pre-builds the entire initial HTML page and sends it over. So it loads instantly, and search engines can read it perfectly.
Best of both worlds.
Right. But once that initial page is loaded, the application hydrates with JavaScript and starts behaving dynamically, just like an SPA. It is incredibly popular for modern e-commerce sites where SEO and speed are both critical.
Speaking of e-commerce, there is a massive trend happening right now called headless, or decoupled architecture. You see platforms like Shopify Headless or Commerce Tools dominating the space. So if I'm tracking this correctly, you are essentially severing the brain of the application, the back-end data, and the logic from the front-end user interface.
That's right.
They're completely separated, only communicating through an API. Why on earth would a business want to intentionally decapitate their own software?
It comes down to one critical advantage: content velocity. Imagine you are a major global retailer. You have a massive e-commerce website. You have an iOS app, an Android app, and maybe you even have interactive digital kiosks inside your physical brick and mortar stores.
Oh, go to touch points.
If your architecture is tightly coupled, meaning the front end and back end are tangled together, changing the promotional banner on the homepage might require an engineer to touch the core database code.
Which means marketing has to wait for a massive engineering deployment just to run a weekend sale. That sounds like an organizational nightmare.
Exactly the problem Headless solves. By going headless and using an API-first design, your back-end data is cleanly exposed. Your marketing team can use a flexible front-end tool to completely redesign the website's interface, test new layouts, and publish instantly without ever touching the back-end logic.
That's huge.
Furthermore, that single headless back-end can feed identical product data and pricing to the website, the mobile apps, and the in-store kiosks simultaneously. You get infinite flexibility on the presentation layer without risking the integrity of your core business logic.
That is brilliant. Okay, so we've designed this beautiful decoupled virtual architecture. We have our microservices, our state management, our headless front end. But at the end of the day, software is not just floating in the ether. It has to live on physical hardware somewhere on planet Earth.
Sadly, yes.
Let's ground this in physical reality, cloud computing and the edge.
Historically, a company had a physical server room. You bought metal racks, routers, switches, and load balancers. If your app went viral and you got a traffic spike, your site crashed until you literally drove to a store, bought more metal boxes, and plugged them into the wall.
Which is terrifying.
Right.
Today, we rely on the cloud, which is really just renting vast amounts of computing power in remote, hyper-efficient data centers.
Right.
And AWS Amazon Web Services is the absolute behemoth in this space.
Yeah.
But instead of just listing their tools, let's trace a user's request. Say I open a web app to view my account dashboard. First, my request hits AWS WAF, a web application firewall that acts as a bouncer, making sure I'm not a malicious bot.
Essential step.
Then it hits CloudFront, which is a networking traffic cop that routes my request. For the actual processing power, my request is handed to EC2, which are virtual servers, or maybe Lambda if it's serverless.
And once that compute layer figures out what you want, it reaches down into the persistence layer. If you are querying structured account details, it pulls from RDS, their relational database service. If it's unstructured data, it pulls from DynamoDB. And if it's fetching your high-resolution profile picture, it grabs it from S3.
So AWS essentially gives developers a massive box of enterprise-grade Lego blocks to build exactly the infrastructure they need.
Exactly.
But the most fascinating shift happening in physical infrastructure right now isn't just massive centralized cloud data centers sitting in Ohio or Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
It's edge computing, moving the compute power and the data geographically closer to the user.
Mm-hmm.
Like if I'm using an app in Tokyo, I don't want my request to travel across the Pacific Ocean and back.
No, you don't.
Think of it like banking. If I want to make a withdrawal, I go to the local branch in my neighborhood. I don't fly to the corporate headquarters in New York every single time I need a $20 bill.
That's a perfect way to visualize it. For years, we've used content delivery networks, or CDNs, to do this for static assets. They cache copies of your images and basic HTML on servers in hundreds of cities around the world.
Okay.
But edge computing goes a massive step further. Platforms like Cloudflare Workers, Vercel Edge Functions, or AWS Lambda at Edge actually allow developers to run the application logic itself at that neighborhood branch.
Wait, really? The logic itself is running on the local tower, not just the static images.
Yes. You can authenticate users, process localized data, and route traffic from a server sitting 50 miles away from the user rather than 5,000 miles away.
Oh, wow.
And the reason this is becoming a standard rather than just a luxury is performance. Google's Core Web Vitals directly measure and penalize slow load times. If you can shave 200 milliseconds off a load time by executing code at the edge, that directly correlates to higher conversion rates, better SEO, and users actually sticking around instead of abandoning the app in frustration.
Speed truly is everything. Now, designing and deploying this globally distributed system is really just day one. The real test is making sure it doesn't spontaneously collapse under the weight of a million users. This brings us to DevOps, observability, and the art of keeping the lights on.
You are talking about operational readiness. The absolute bedrock of this is CI/CD, continuous integration and continuous delivery. It's an automated pipeline.
Right.
Every time an engineer writes a new piece of code, it doesn't just go live. The pipeline automatically runs hundreds of tests against it.
And this includes techniques like blue-green deployments, right? Where you essentially have two identical production environments. The blue environment is live, handling all the current user traffic. The green environment is idle, and you deploy your new code there.
Yes.
You test it out, and when you're sure it works, you just flip a router switch. Traffic instantly moves from blue to green. If the new code immediately breaks, you just flip the switch back to blue. Zero downtime.
Exactly. It removes the terror from deployment. But inevitably, a bug will slip through. When it does, you need observability. Think of a complex microservice architecture as a giant dark haystack.
And you need to find the needle.
Right. And observability gives you a flashlight, and it relies on three pillars. First, you have logs. This is the application's diary, a searchable chronological record of every specific event that happened, usually managed by something like the ELK stack.
Second, you have metrics. If logs are the diary, metrics are the patient's heart rate monitor. They are quantitative measurements, CPU usage, memory spikes, error rates aggregated over time using tools like Prometheus to show you the overall health of the system.
And the third, most crucial pillar for distributed systems is traces. Because a single user action might trigger 10 different microservices, a trace attaches a unique ID to that request. You can literally follow its exact path through the network, seeing exactly which specific microservice caused the bottleneck. Tools like OpenTelemetry or AWS X-Ray act like a GPS tracker for your data.
Beyond observability, there are structural best practices. Implementing strategic caching, for instance. If you do a complex database query, you cache the result. The next time a user asks the same question, you just hand them the cached answer instantly, instead of making the database do the math all over again.
Huge time saver.
Or designing for failure, using circuit breakers if a service starts failing. The circuit breaker trips, stopping traffic to that service so it has time to recover without bringing down the whole system.
Yeah.
But then, amidst all this high-tech wizardry, there are ADRs, architecture decision records. These are literally just simple, markdown text documents that record why a specific engineering decision was made. So what does this all mean? Are basic text documents genuinely considered a core component of software architecture?
This raises an important question about what architecture truly is. We spend so much time talking about code, servers, and automated pipelines, but software architecture is fundamentally about the human system managing it. The reality is, engineering teams change. Senior developers leave, new people are hired.
So when a brilliant new engineer looks at the code base and says, wow, why did they build this specific feature in such a bizarre, convoluted way? I'm going to fix it and make it simpler.
And then they accidentally delete the bizarre workaround that was specifically designed to prevent a catastrophic failure edge case.
Ah, yikes.
Without ADRs, historical context is lost. An ADR is a time capsule. It tells that new engineer, we made this decision on this date under these constraints to solve this specific problem. It prevents teams from repeating incredibly expensive mistakes. The documentation of the system is just as vital as the code itself.
That is a profound way to look at it.
Yeah.
And it brings all of this abstract theory down to reality, which is perfectly illustrated by the real-world case studies we have from Scopic. Take a project like Medifany. It's a IPA-compliant medical app for radiology. They use high-quality 3D models and video reports for MRI and CT scans.
Right. And you can immediately see why architecture matters there. You need an incredibly robust, high-bandwidth storage solution for those massive visual files, paired with airtight, military-grade security protocols to protect patient privacy and comply with federal regulations. The architecture is the product's viability.
Or look at Rehab Bookings, an application focused entirely on the user journey. A pristine, decoupled architecture ensures that all the massive complexity on the back end, searching multiple facility locations, verifying dates, processing inquiry logic, doesn't bog down the presentation layer. The user just experiences a fast, intuitive, frictionless interface.
And my personal favorite example is RxWeb. They were managing a legacy pharmacy application built on ancient technology like Flash and Cold Fusion.
Flash? Wow.
Yeah. As modern browsers stopped supporting Flash, they faced an existential crisis. Synscopic came in and completely revolutionized their architecture.
They moved to Angular and TypeScript on the front end to create a modern SPA experience, rebuilt the back end using Java, and, crucially, they implemented RabbitMQ, which we talked about earlier. They used event-driven architecture to ensure absolute resilience when processing pharmacy data. They took a monolithic, dying relic and transformed it into a scalable, modern system.
It is the perfect illustration of the technology lifecycle. The expectations of users will always eventually outgrow the capabilities of old framework.
This is an endless cycle of innovation and evolution. In just a few minutes, we have journeyed all the way from the basic divide of the front-end dining room and the back-end kitchen through the evolution of monolithic warehouses into sprawling microservice cities, all the way out to executing complex logic at the global edge of the network.
The underlying complexity is staggering, but the ultimate goal remains beautifully, elegantly simple. Deliver the data securely, accurately, and instantly.
The next time you open an app on your phone to check your bank balance or order dinner, and it feels agonizingly slow or clunky, I want you to pause and think about that invisible architecture running underneath the glass. What bottleneck is causing that friction? Is it a massive monolithic backend struggling to breathe under a sudden surge of traffic? Or is it a lack of edge caching, forcing your poor phone to painstakingly fetch every tiny image from a server sitting halfway across the world? The invisible digital world is always running, constantly working to keep the illusion seamless. You just have to know how to look at it.